all three of the babies has sounded really great during the whole labor whenever we listened. So there was never a concern. One of the other midwives said to me at one point, do you think she's dilated? And I said, oh yeah, she's probably complete. We should check her. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm not checking her. And I said, I'm not going to stick my hands. She hasn't asked. And she wanted her mother to receive the babies. Her husband didn't want to. And her mother had been at all of her births. And she's like, I want my mom. And she told me this prenatally. I said, oh, that's fine. That's great. Because I don't like to receive the babies. I like the mom to do it, or the dad, or somebody of their choosing. I don't want to be the first person to touch somebody else's baby.
I'm Cynthia Overgaard, owner of Hypnobirthing of Connecticut, childbirth advocate, and postpartum support specialist.
And I'm Tricia Ludwig, certified nurse midwife and international board-certified lactation consultant.
And this is the Down to Birth podcast.
Childbirth is something we're made to do, but how do we have our safest and most satisfying experience in today's medical culture?
Let's dispel the myths and get down to birth.
Hi, I'm Christine Loria, and I've been a midwife for 35 years. I was community-based for a very long time, and now I work for Doctors Without Borders doing humanitarian aid in very low-resource settings, including refugee camps and conflict zones, disasters, and so forth. And so I work with a very high-risk population with very little resources, as the name would imply. And so because of that, I've seen a wide variety of things beyond what one might see in a home birth, and things that we would ordinarily, of course, risk out in a place like the U.S. where we have good resources and are able to get more succinct medical care for mothers and babies. And so in light of that, I have a nice collection of wonderful stories. I've attended a lot of breaches, over 500 multiples, including triplets. And this is what I'm here to talk about today, a most recent triplet home birth here in the U.S.
I love this because when you remove the institution of birth, when you remove the medical influence, and especially the liability piece of it, when you go to these countries where they're just happy to have somebody there to attend their birth, who knows what they're doing, this is how we can build so much more trust and confidence and faith in birth, because we're removing all those elements and we're just allowing it to be, because that's the only choice.
Absolutely. And this is how I have seen what's possible in birth. Because here, if we, for example, you know, people say, oh, well, the doctor would not allow my twins to go past X amount of weeks, and they wanted to induce or do a cesarean because, you know, sometimes that's just what they do, especially if one of them is presenting breech. And so physicians don't really, they're not able to see what would happen if they allowed, in little quotes, a woman to go to term with, you know, monitoring. I'm not saying just throw caution to the wind, but not, you know, just not inducing unless there's a clear indication, other than just, you know, there was a study that came out 20 years ago that said X, Y, and Z. And so now we're all following suit with that. Because if midwives came forth with information that was 20 years old as to why they're doing a particular practice, we would get laughed at by the medical establishment, but they're doing the exact same thing. Nobody knows how long twins would go if we just allowed them to gestate. I do, because I've attended twins at home, and I can see that most women that are healthy and well-nourished will go to term if they don't develop certain complications earlier in their pregnancy. But the ones that do not risk out absolutely can go to term safely with their babies, including triplets.
I always wonder about the same thing when they share data on when first-time moms give birth and what those babies weigh, because such a high number of women are induced that it lowers both of those numbers. And I think most of us are unsuspecting to that fact. For example, in Nancy Wainer's population, just by being close friends with her, it's truly staggering when you see how many women go past 42 weeks. Do you agree with that in your own personal experience?
Yes, absolutely.
Many physicians haven't even seen a physiologic birth of a singleton. Exactly. I always talk about the circle of safety, and midwives have such a broader circle of safety in birth because they have seen so much more undisturbed birth, and they have seen what is possible. And in the medical model and in the physician OB scope, it's so narrow. So the second something seems to, you know, not be following the Friedman curve, the birth is a problem and an intervention is needed. So we are very excited today to hear the story of an incredible triplet home birth, which is pretty much unheard of in this country. And where did this take place?
This was in Tennessee. So I was contacted by Amber, and she's fine with her story being told. Obviously, her video has gone viral, our birth video. So if you haven't seen it, you can check it out. So she's fine with her name being used. But I was contacted by her early in her pregnancy. She had also contacted an obstetrician friend of mine and asked if we would be able to, one of us at least, would be able to attend her triplet birth. And I had attended a triplet birth last year, and she got my number from that mother. And I said, well, you know, I talked to her about all the things, you know, her general history and so forth. This was going to be her, she was a G7. So she had given birth 6 other times. She has 5 children, and then one was a surrogate pregnancy. So she has 5 children at home and then one not at home, but she's given birth 6 times uneventfully. Once was at home, and she had wanted another home birth. And then she realized she was having triplets, so she thought it wasn't possible. These were tri triplets, which means they were all in their own amnion and chorion. They were just 3 separate babies. So they're siblings. They're not identicals. And she had 2 girls and a boy. And so she was telling me about all of these things. All of her pregnancies had been uneventful. She never had any issues giving birth, with postpartum hemorrhage, nothing, no blood pressure issues, no diabetes issues. So the chances of her getting through this pregnancy, she's 31 years old, were actually pretty good getting to 36 weeks, which is what I told her would be my personal cutoff time. I would not want to attend her any earlier than that. There can be too many issues with needing transfer for at least one of the babies. And so she said that was fine. And she knew that eating was going to be a full-time job just to get enough in to be able to nourish herself and the babies. She was great the entire time. And she got to 23 weeks, I believe, 23 or 24. And she started leaking fluid. And there was a little bit of blood as well. Immediately went into the hospital, and she messaged me. She sent me an email saying, oh, this is what they're saying at the hospital. I'm like, oh, she's going to risk out now. And everything was good with the babies. Clearly the bag sealed. They did diagnose a subchorionic hemorrhage, which is just a little bit of hemorrhage area at one of the placenta sites. But it all just kind of healed up. She kind of sat there for about 2 weeks at the hospital, and they said, you know, we're just going to keep you here until you hit 32 to 34 weeks, and then we will do a C-section and put your babies in the NICU until their due date. And she said, I don't think so. And she was consulting. So I was listening to her and hearing what she was saying, but I said, you know, I'm a midwife. This is the time in the pregnancy that I don't manage. These are the things that I don't take care of here in the U.S. So talk to my colleague who's a physician, and he will tell you, you know, what is possible, what they're saying is true and so forth. And he basically said, nah, you're fine. If you want to sign out AMA, you should. Because she's like, I'm just lying here in the bed. The food is terrible. And I can do this at home and have better food and be with my other children, because it will be less stressful for me. And so that's what she did.
Right. She was away from all those children all that time.
Yeah. She has a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. Okay. So now she has 5 under 2, all in diapers. But so yes, she was away from her 1-year-old and her 2-year-old.
And don't we have evidence, good evidence, that suggests that bed rest is not helpful in preventing preterm labor?
I mean, yeah, pretty much. And she wasn't contracting, and the subchorionic hemorrhage had healed, and she wasn't leaking any more fluid, and she was, all of her vitals were fine. The babies, every time they listened to them, were fine. And she said, I can go in for ultrasounds every few weeks and check. And that's what she did. She went home. She got home on Thanksgiving Day, I think. And she did it. She made it to 36 weeks. She grew some nice, healthy babies. And so I joined her at 36 weeks and met her for the first time. And we had nice talk, and talked about all, just, I just wanted to hear about her pregnancy and everything, and all the things that she hoped to accomplish with her birth, how she saw her birth happening and unfolding. And so that's what we did. We spent most of the time doing that. And I visited every few days. Because I was worried about anything, but just because A, she didn't know me and I didn't know her. And we had this short amount of time to build up this trust. She had a wonderful midwife that had been following her whole pregnancy, Talitha. And so she knew Talitha well, but she had not attended any multiples. And so she did not want to do this birth without that kind of experience. And so we put together a team. Talitha found another midwife who did have experience with twins. And so she joined us. And then there were 3 students as well. So I was going every few days because, of course, we have 3 babies to check on and 1 mom. And anything can change at any point in time. And so in that last month, I really do like that more close of a check-in, so I can detect anything that might be rapidly changing overnight, or if there's a blood pressure spike or suddenly there's swelling. She had no swelling. Her blood pressure was actually too low for my taste. It did end up going up a little bit more at the end, which was great. Everything was really quite good.
Logistically, where were you staying?
Logistically, I was staying at an Airbnb about 35 minutes from her.
Because you live 12 hours from her.
Because I live 12 hours away. Yeah.
And did Talitha get the privilege of witnessing this multiples birth since she didn't have experience with it?
Yeah. So it was Shannon and Talitha and me. And then there were 3 students. One of them was Shannon's, who was happened to be an ICU nurse who was studying to be a midwife. And so she was actually very useful because I knew she could do IVs. I knew she wouldn't panic. And then the students were less experienced. And so they were doing the charting. And then, of course, all of the things in between, the cleanup and the chucks pads and all of that stuff. But the 3 of us as midwives were checking the heart tones and doing all the more midwifey things during the actual birth.
Hey there, all you amazing, strong, and beautiful women, especially you new moms and moms-to-be. I'm Taylor, co-founder and CEO of Vitality.
And I'm Taylor's sister, Chloe, co-founder and chief design officer. We started Vitality to encourage and empower everyone to live a vibrant life. We're all about supporting women, especially on the journey to motherhood.
When I was pregnant, I really struggled to find comfy leggings that I could wear all day, every day. So we set out to make the best maternity pants out there. We took those pain points and designed pieces that were supportive and comfortable, including details like a high-rise fit, underbelly seam, raw-cut hems, and to top it off, we have an embedded silicone panel that acts like a built-in suspension system for your low back, which is the first of its kind.
So we designed this line in our Marshmallow Soft Cloud 2 fabric in not only a maternity pant, but a volley and biker short as well.
Let me tell you, all of these pieces are a game changer.
Just go to shopvitality.com.
And cherry on top, you guys can use code DOWNTOBIRTH at checkout to get 10% off your order.
10% off athleisure, designed for pregnancy, during pregnancy.
Down to Birth is sponsored by Postpartum Soothe.
Recovering from a vaginal birth takes many women by surprise. Everyday activities like sitting, walking, and going to the bathroom can be uncomfortable, and Postpartum Soothe is just the remedy to support your healing and relieve discomfort. Postpartum Soothe is a 100% organic herbal blend that's applied to maternity pads in the days immediately following your birth, giving you all the benefits of a sitz bath 24/7. That's because herbs like comfrey leaf, uva ursi, and witch hazel are known for their antimicrobial and anti-inflammatory properties. Postpartum Soothe can be prepared anytime during the third trimester, and it makes a beautiful baby gift. It's a must for any woman seeking a faster, easier recovery from a vaginal birth. Visit postpartumsoothe.com. That's postpartumsoothe, SOOTHE.com, and use promo code DOWNTOBIRTH. Did you know that 97% of women take a prenatal vitamin, yet 95% of us are still deficient in key nutrients for pregnancy and postpartum? After a long time searching for the optimal prenatal nutrition product, we bring you Needed, a radically better prenatal vitamin. Needed's nutritional products offer nutrients that your body can utilize with doses at optimal versus bare minimum levels and are available in capsules and an easy-to-take vanilla powder, perfect for those moms with pill fatigue or nausea. Needed is a woman-founded company offering a superior nutritional product lineup backed by research, data, and insights from nearly 4,000 women's health experts. Needed offers premium supplements for every stage, from egg quality support for women trying to conceive to lactation support for breastfeeding. And you know, Cynthia and I, we love their botanical sleep and relaxation support packets before bedtime. So if you are looking for a radically different prenatal, head on over to thisisneeded.com and enter Down to Birth for 20% off your first order.
I like people to appreciate the responsible approach to things like this, because when you see the headline, triplets born at home, most of the nation would just see that and immediately feel like, oh, they were so lucky everyone survived and that was so risky. But when you hear about the staff that you put together, the team that you put together to surround this woman, she was in perhaps better hands than she might have been in any other setting.
Yeah. She knew that at any point in time, she could potentially risk out. It wasn't something that was thrown in her face all the time, like, okay, I'm going to check you now. You might risk out today. It wasn't like that. It was like, we're going to check and see how great everything is and how well the babies are growing and so forth. I really like to palpate the babies well, so I get to know them and their positions and all of that, so that I'm better able to manage things at the birth. And so this is, you know, I'm a traditional midwife. I have certifications and things, but my training 35 years ago was as a traditional midwife. So I use my ears and my hands.
Let's touch on that for a second, because sure. Of course, in any other environment, she would have been having weekly NSTs, if not twice weekly, ultrasounds. And you just said that you are monitoring the babies very carefully with your hands. Can you just explain a little bit to everybody listening of how that works?
Sure.
And why you trust that?
Yeah. So, you know, she was getting ultrasounds. And at the end, she had a couple of biophysical profiles, which were useful to just know that everything on, aside from just my judgment, a separate entity has said, here's the report. All three of these babies look good. But aside from that, their weight estimates weren't that great. And so for me, checking the babies with my hands and being able to palpate them and their positions, which, you know, it was actually quite easy to do. And I could tell just how big the babies were. And I could tell that they were growing. And I was measuring her uterus. Her uterus, in the end, measured 52 centimeters. Okay. So normally at term, it would be 40. So it's, it was a lot. It was a nice big belly, but I could palpate the amount of fluid that was in. And when I do these things, I talk to the mother and I tell her what I'm doing and what I'm feeling all along the way. That's what I do with all of the mothers. It's like, okay, I can feel this here and I feel that here. And the baby feels to be about like this and it's facing this way. And this is why I know this. And are you getting, where the movements here? Are they there? Yes, they're right over here. Okay. Yep. Because that's where I'm feeling the little feet or whatever. And then, you know, with my hands on either side of her belly, if I can kind of just push back and forth and just see everything moving, there's plenty of fluid. You can feel the fluid pockets there. When it feels like babies encased in like cellophane and there's no movement, and they're not belaudable, I know that there's less fluid. And so I learned this ages ago because I practiced illegally for 17 years and I didn't have access to ultrasound. So I had to learn what this feels like. And so this is how I know.
I want to talk about this a little bit.
Yeah.
One feeling I have is I'm just so sad that this is a dying art. There's a generation of midwives that are taking this skill with them.
Yeah.
And they're practicing, and now they've practiced for decades, and the new young midwives following them don't have this ability. They don't have this skill. They're learning how ultrasound machines are working rather than how to use and trust, as you trust your senses to, and you said, to get to know these babies. You know, I mean, that's what it feels like for you. It feels like you know these children before they come. This one likes to be like this, and this one likes to be like that. Can you talk a little bit about what it means to be a traditional midwife and what you meant when you said you practiced unlicensed for 17 years? Can you please talk a little bit about those two things? How were you initially trained, and what did you mean by all of that?
Yes, sure. So I had a traditional apprenticeship. I worked with a midwife in the Amish community, and I actually worked with another midwife about an hour south. This was in Ohio, who happened to be a CNM, who had been in a home birth midwife prior to going into CNM school. So I got to work with a traditional midwife and a CNM who practiced a lot like a traditional midwife, but just had all the CNM knowledge. And so I got to work with both of them, which was really very cool. And so I had kind of a dual apprenticeship. And so I was attending a lot of births every month, especially in the Amish community. So 12, 15 births a month. So I got a lot of experience quite quickly. And again, we couldn't just order labs. We couldn't just do an ultrasound or refer for an ultrasound. If they wanted an ultrasound, they'd have to go in to see a doctor, and then the doctor would order the ultrasound, but we couldn't just order it. And then they would oftentimes have to lie and not say they were having a home birth, because they would get treated very poorly. And so this is kind of what it was like practicing back then. It was very, it was difficult. I didn't even use a Doppler for, several years. Like, it was only a fetoscope. So I got very good with it. And I still am very good with it. And I do believe that is a dying art, as is palpation skills, and really understanding, exactly where everything, they're taught Leopold's maneuvers, but it's really not enough, especially judging by the amount of quote unquote surprise breaches people say they're encountering. And I'm like, well, are they a surprise or are they undiagnosed?
Right. Oh, baby just turned in labor. No, it didn't. It was a missed breach all along.
Exactly. And that's the great majority of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And everybody is using midwives now. It's just ultrasound to detect the baby's position. And so nobody's putting their hands on a mother's belly anymore. And so you don't have that fine tuned sense of fluid levels that are actually going to detect too little or too much fluid better than an ultrasound, which has a very inaccurate, assessment of size and fluid levels.
Yeah. Yeah. I just get a lot of information with my hands. And after all of these years, it's also a very intuitive thing, like something's not right here. And in fact, it was interesting because when I was, coming up through the traditional midwife route, so there was no CPM credential at that time, or it was just a NARM was just beginning to be, and there were whispers of, you can be certified this or that, but that also wasn't recognized in any states. It's not like it is now. And so for me, it was like, well, we'll have to just practice illegally like all these midwives in all of these places.
Was it illegal, or was it
the practice of midwifery was illegal? Yeah. There are places where, you can't practice midwifery unless you have a license. And then in a lot of these states, there hadn't been licensure. So
that was what I was asking. Okay. That was the reason that they were illegal, because they had to be licensed and they didn't have a process for getting licensed.
because that it was before the CPM route. And now, you know, now many, I think there's 35 states that will have, that have CPM recognition.
What does traditional midwife mean to you? We've had this conversation on the podcast before, and the conversation was a little, it was unclear. I think the, So what does it mean to you?
Yeah, it's pretty unclear because there's no specific definition for it. It's somebody that is using their knowledge and skills to pretty much do nothing unless or until nothing needs to be done. Traditional midwives, they do, you know, the expectant approach in birth, and they view birth as a normal physiological process that the great majority of the time intervention is not needed.
It sounds like it means midwives drawing upon generations of experience and passing down those skills from one generation to the next. Yes. And they're learning it not in a classroom. I mean, it's so different from what Trisha went to an Ivy League school, sat in their classrooms, did God knows how many hours of studying and exams before attending her births. And there you were at births before you were at births before you really learned much. You learned on the job, it seems. It's just such a different approach. Does that characterize it well?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I had to actually unlearn a great deal of what I learned in midwifery school so that I could learn the true art of midwifery, which I was fortunate enough to go into the home birth arena after graduation and learn actually from more traditional midwives how to fine tune those midwifery skills that I didn't actually get in midwifery school. So the traditional midwife to me is the midwife who has been trained through the art of midwifery, through apprenticeship, through, just like Cynthia said, generations of women who have that deep wisdom of birth, not what's taught in Varney's textbook. Although that's important to know some of that stuff. There's great information in there, but it's missing an element. And that's
yes. And I think you're spot on there. And I'm fortunate that I was able to have that kind of experience. And then my mentor of 30 years, she died a couple of years ago. She had been practicing for 54 years. And since she was 12 years old with her Cherokee grandmother. And so that was just some very ancient ancestral knowledge. And so I think that there are... you know, there are different types of midwives, and there's a place for all the different types of midwives. And regardless of whatever certifications and licensure that I might have, ultimately, I consider myself a traditional midwife. And less is more, the greater majority of the time, even with something like triplets.
So tell us more. We want to hear the story. When did she go into labor? Tell us the details.
Yeah. So her last biophysical profile was about, I think, 6 days before she went into labor. And it was 8 out of 8 for all 3 babies. But the person reading the BPP was like, these babies need to come out. And we're like, but why? Called the midwife, Talitha, to panic that because she was already 37 weeks and some change. And this is just unheard of. And just horrible things are going to happen.
It's just crazy. Like, they had a perfect biophysical profile. It's like they want to find something wrong. They want to find something wrong so they can say we need to get the babies out. They find nothing wrong with 3 babies in there, and they say we still have to get the babies out. It's like we could have skipped this step and gone straight to the argument if you want.
Yeah. So
what happened?
She turned 38 weeks, and I checked on her right at 38 weeks. Everybody felt good. They were growing and moving. Baby A was cephalic. Baby B was breech. Those were the girls. And then the little boy was up top, transverse.
Oh, my goodness. And they went in a perfect loop together. One is head down, one is up, and one is across. Like they made a little triangle. Was that a comfortable position to find those babies in? Because there really is nothing much else that nature can do when there are 3 in there. Is that typical for triplets to be in that position?
I think the last ones I did was cephalic, breech. So I think they find their own way. But it wouldn't be uncommon to have at least one of them in a breech position.
But it's the transverse that gets my attention. Transverse is always a concerning term, but in this case, it isn't, right? Because there's going to be so much space with one or both of those other babies born first.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that one just hasn't had a chance to move into the position it's going to be born in yet.
Right.
Exactly. And I attend a lot of multiples, and I always tell the parents, as long as the first baby is in a longitudinal lie, I don't care what it is, breech or cephalic, I'm good. The second baby can be doing anything it wants because it's going to change. There's a 20% chance that if it is in a longitudinal lie, that it's going to flip one way or another. And if it's transverse, it's easily enough either moved or usually they'll just come and change on their own once the first baby is out. So I'm never worried about that second baby or that transverse baby. But if there's a distress, then we have to address that straight away. And so I told her if there was any distress with that baby at any point that I might need to do an extraction and, you know, would she consent to that? And she understood. And she said, yep, whatever you need to do to get my babies out safely. I said, hopefully we won't need to, but just so you know. And I explained what that looked like. And so she consented at that point.
Can you explain to us what a home birth extraction looks like? Typically, we're talking about, you know, forceps or something like that.
No, it's a manual extraction. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I'm happy to, I can explain it when I get into the birth story as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah, keep going. Let's hear it.
Yeah. So.
I had one more question. I'm sorry, but I know that listeners will want to hear. What did the biophysical profiles reassure you of? What exactly are they checking? How do you get to that 8 out of 8?
Yeah. Measure? So they're checking the fluid level, and they're checking the breathing of the baby. There's scores. It's 2 for each category. And they're checking all the different, each baby for the
movement.
Different movement. Mm-hmm.
Grimace. Okay. Isn't grimace? No, that's Apgar.
He did not say grimace.
That is a
see the baby grimacing. So
that's great.
You might.
They will believe me now. No, that Drisha said it. Someone's going to say we need to do that. We need to now do that with ultrasound and see the expression on the baby's faces before we can let you continue with this pregnancy. That's just hilarious. Well,
they do monitor breathing on the biophysical profile. Do we see breathing movements? But it's just an assessment of the well-being of the baby.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they tried to talk her into staying. She didn't. She went home, spoke to you. Did you say she was at 38 weeks with triplets? Did you say 38?
Yeah, she called me at 38 and 2 in labor. And her last labor had been about 8 hours. So I figured this one would be around the same, and perhaps maybe a little bit shorter. But she called me straight away. And I went over there right away also because she was already feeling like it was active labor. She vomits throughout active labor, and she was already vomiting. And so I said, I'm on my way. And so as she labored the majority of the time, just lying on her side in bed, because of all the vomiting, we offered to put in an IV and give her some fluids because a uterus does not work well if it is not well hydrated. Mm-hmm. She was not able to hydrate herself because she was vomiting. So we gave her some fluids for that, because even a distended uterus, you know, we always have concerns like how well is this uterus going to contract with multiples, right? So there's always that. And it was contracting quite well. And I think it was probably complete for a while as well.
I want to just make a comment on the IV, because I think that most people think that that's not, one, we talk about it as being an unnecessary intervention in the hospital, but two, most people think that that isn't something that is done at home, and it is, and it actually can be one of the things that prevents a home birth from making a transfer. So it's a really important skill for midwives to have, because dehydration, especially in the case of vomiting, really can, you know, cause a labor to peter out. And also it is helpful if a woman is hemorrhaging. So it's a great intervention when we need it.
Yeah, yes, and to be done at home. And sometime a few months ago, I was reading quite a bit of research on water and hydration and labor, and I was astonished at how important being sufficiently hydrated is. And I know how important in general. I know we all tell women how much water to drink, but when you read the data on it and how it affects amniotic fluid and how it affects the uterus, it's like, I'm sold, hand me the water, because it had a radical effect on the baby's health, on how the birth went. So it is a real risk if a woman has diarrhea or is vomiting excessively in labor. She really can get dehydrated. It's very interesting, though. I haven't heard that come up in a home birth story on this podcast. I'm glad you shared that.
And not all home birth midwives in all states can do IVs. Some states prohibit it, actually. Wow. But I had talked to her ahead of time about it, especially with the potential of excessive bleeding afterwards, because it's almost a given with triplets, because the placenta is a placental area and the uterus is so large. So it's not even necessarily a hemorrhage. It's just a lot of extra blood. So she knew that an IV was a possibility, and it was fine. She was lying there and they put the IV in. We were able to get her hydrated, and then we unhooked it and we kept the access so that we could give her more fluids later if needed. And so that was good to go. She was lying in bed anyway. So it wasn't like she was tethered to this thing, because she didn't want to walk around anyway. And so eventually, I said, you're probably dilated completely. And I think she probably had been for a while. I said, if you want these babies to come, you're probably going to need to get up.
Let me ask you a question right there.
Yeah.
You know, Nancy Wehner, we talked about that before we started recording. Nancy doesn't tend to practice giving vaginal exams to women in labor during the home births she attends. And it sounds like you're the same type of practicing midwife. Did you just say that because you suspected she was fully dilated, but you didn't do a vaginal exam? Am I hearing that right?
No, I didn't do a vaginal exam. She did not need one. And one of the other midwives said to me at one point, she kind of whispered in my ears, do you think she's dilated? And I said, oh yeah, she's probably complete. We should check her. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm not checking her. And I said, I'm not going to stick my hands. She hasn't asked for it to be done. And had she asked, I would have said, well, why don't you get up and see what, because I knew what she needed was gravity so that baby went right down into that pelvis. And so she did get up. And I said, get up and go pee, and then maybe try walking around just a little bit. She went up, she got up, went into the bathroom, and she's like, yep, I can feel her coming down. And she comes back to the bedroom, and then she just breathes it sounded like a sigh or just kind of like a, and the first baby just started to come. And she wanted her mother to receive the babies. Her husband didn't want to. And her mother had been at all of her births. And she's like, I want my mom. And she told me this prenatally. I said, oh, that's fine. That's great. Because I don't like to receive the babies. I like the mom to do it, or the dad, or somebody of their choosing. I don't want to be the first person to touch somebody else's baby. Right. So I was thrilled that the grandma was there. So I was right next to her. And, you can see it on the video, and the baby's coming, and it's in the amniotic sac. And as the head's born, the sac breaks, and the head and shoulders came at the same time, and just right out into grandma's hands. And she was standing, Amber was standing. And so she just put Ilana through her legs, and she grabbed her and then sat down and talked to her. And the cord was quite short.
I hope women can hear the respect and reverence that you have for the mother and her babies. I mean, the fact that you didn't even dare ask to do a vaginal exam when you didn't feel one was necessary. And the fact that you didn't even want to be the first hand, when you think about how doctors walk around saying, I delivered how many babies today, just that language that they delivered the baby, and you didn't even want to place your hands on that baby. You wanted a family member to do it. It just says so much about the love and respect that belongs in that birth space. Is that what it feels like for you? Does it?
Yeah, no, I feel very much like, the a birth is a very sacred thing. It's one of the most important events in a woman's life, if not like the most important and life defining. And our birth experiences really shape who we are as women and certainly as mothers. And I just have a real reverence for the process. And I just have a tremendous amount of respect for the families. And I understand that, yes, while I might be hired and being paid, I'm still an invited guest into this moment in their lives. And my job is to help everybody get safely to the other side. And most of the time that means just sitting back and watching. I've said this many times, people who know me have heard me say it, but I consider talking at a birth and intervention, talking from the midwife. The family can say whatever they want. And if you listen to the birth video, you will hear the people talking are the dad, the grandma, the son, her 13-year-old son was there. You can hear me say, as the grandma caught, because the grandma had never received a baby. And I said, you hear me say, reach down and get your baby, honey, because I wanted to make her. But that's all I said. I wasn't coaching the pushing and cheering. And no one else was either of the team, because they knew they'd be in trouble probably because I'm so strict. But I'm just very clear about that, because that every word robs this family of a little bit of their story. And when you hear Amber tell her story, the greatest compliment to me was, I was hardly a footnote in her story. She hardly mentioned me. She said the team was great and this and that, but she and her babies and her family, it was all about them. And I'm like, I did it right. Like, I feel really good when somebody tells their story and I'm not the big hero and I'm not in the spotlight. I know that I've done it right. So that's how I, that's how I feel about it. So thank you for recognizing that.
It's a really beautiful example of the difference between the midwifery model of care, traditional midwifery model of care, and the medical management of birth. Like, that right there just explains it. One is I'm center stage, and the other one is I'm in the corner. You, the mother, is center stage, and I am only here when needed, when something goes off course.
There's a hypnobirthing video of a woman giving birth in Florida a few years ago, and everyone's speaking Spanish in the room. So she's there with, she's in the bed, and the birth is totally calm. But when you have this other perspective, you see you feel the longing for it to go a little differently. She's in the bed. She's in the hospital gown. She's totally beautiful, calm, gentle presence. Her husband is on an iPad on a couch on the other side of the room. And she's in the bed as the baby starts coming out on her. She's on her back as the baby is coming out. The doctor walks in, puts on gloves, grabs the baby by the head and starts pulling. And he's going, "Saka, saka, saka," which is like, "Take your baby, take it, take it, take it, take it." He's screaming over and over with the baby's head out. He's saying to the woman, like, "Take your baby, take it, take it, take it." And she's instructed to start like pulling her baby up and out. And the baby lands on the hospital gown. She's hugging the baby on the hospital gown. And this is the part I was getting at. The husband looks moved, as you would expect. And he starts hugging the doctor kind of from behind, from the side. He's hugging the doctor. And then he kisses the doctor on the cheek. He kisses the doctor and squeezes the doctor's shoulders. And I point that out to my clients and I say, the only reason he kisses the doctor is because he bought the fallacy that the doctor just got the baby into the world safely.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
And then we hear a story from a woman like you, and it just makes me emotional hearing it, because again, it's your reverence. And that's why the mother, she probably loves you with all her heart and will the rest of her life, but you were not a key player in the story.
No.
Finding the perfect pregnancy and breastfeeding bra is no easy task. Your search is now over. Meet Davin and Adley, a mother-owned pumping, nursing, and maternity bra company with a unique, comfortable, and stylish cropped cami. This item is perfect to wear all day long from day one of your pregnancy right through the end of your breastfeeding journey and probably beyond. The Amelia Cami makes pumping and breastfeeding easy while looking and feeling good on your body. It works seamlessly for both wearable pumps and flange pumps, and you can breastfeed in it. It also has a beautiful stretch lace back. You can sleep in it, dress up in it, go out in it, whatever you want to do in it. And trust us, the quality in this item and all of their items are top notch. They're soft, durable, and attractive. These bras will truly go the distance. Davin and Adley carry a gorgeous selection of maternity and nursing wear, and they have an innovative one-piece breast pad that we've never seen anywhere else. So no more losing those solo breast pads, ladies. Go ahead and check out the full collection of maternity and nursing items at davinandadley.com and use your promo code DOWNTOBIRTH to save 15%. All right, breastfeeding moms, do you want to know one of our all-time favorite items for your nursing journey? If you know us, you probably could guess it. Yep, it's the Silverette Nursing Cup. These little nipple heroes not only protect, but also heal because they're made of real silver. It is naturally antimicrobial, antifungal, and anti-inflammatory. These little cups will be your best friend in the early sensitive weeks of breastfeeding your baby. And our favorite part is they last literally forever. You can pass them on just like you would a favorite piece of jewelry. Head on over to silveretteusa.com and use promo code DOWNTOBIRTH to save 15%.
Nope. And I'm very happy for that. I knew her birth history. I knew she wouldn't need anything from me. I knew anything that might be needed would be something like, yeah, an IV for hydration. And maybe help with hemorrhage, assessment of fetal positions, because the other midwives weren't 100% comfortable, you know, doing multiples like that. So that's what she wanted me there for, just to make sure everything was going okay. And so if I didn't need to do something, I wasn't going to.
So when did baby two come?
So about an hour later. So she went to lie down with baby A and nurse. The cord was pretty short. So, and it had pretty much stopped any kind of pulsing. And so we cut it because it was short. She couldn't bring it up to her breast. And she would lie there and nurse the baby. And then she started to feel some contractions. And I said, you know what you're going to have to do, right? You're going to have to get up again and be in a vertical position in order for this next baby to come out. Because I would have been fine with her side lying or being in the bed, but just wasn't going to come down into the pelvis. And I knew that. And so she did. She got up and did the same sort of thing where, you know, she just paced a little bit and then started that, you know, that big, heavy sigh sort of breathing. And she was standing there with her back to us, and grandma was right there, and this big water balloon comes down and it just keeps coming down. And it was the baby coming breech, Frank breech. So its legs were folded up with the feet by the ears, but it was in the amniotic sac. You could see the umbilical cord in there right next to the baby. And the baby was coming out directly posterior, breech, sacrum posterior, which is really quite fascinating and fairly rare. Not rare with multiples I've found, but just generally. And that would be something where some providers would want to intervene, but she was pushing, she was getting, the baby was coming down quite well. It rotated ever so slightly to an oblique and then just came out completely in the sac right into the grandma's hands. And that was Ivy. And she passed her through the legs as well. And Amber grabbed her and sat down, and she was covered in vernix and looked very different from her sister, who had her sister had a lot of hair. She didn't. So that was another just beautiful, successful birth. And then we immediately, when each baby was born, we immediately listened to the heart tones. The other midwives grabbed the Dopplers and were listening to the other babies. That's a very important part, you know, assessing the fetal well-being in between. And so we immediately listened. And then baby C was still in the transverse, but I said, if you lie down on your side and nurse Ivy, I'm pretty sure that he's not going to like that, because you're going to be bothering either his butt or his head, regardless of what, depending on what side you're on. And he's going to want to shift. And he did. He was starting to shift to a breech position, which is what we needed. We were listening to him. He sounded great. All three of the babies has sounded really great during the whole labor whenever we listened. So there was never a concern. And then she started to get some contractions. And I said, okay, well, let's get you up again, because we're going to have to get this baby into the pelvis. And as she was getting up, her membranes released. And so it was a lot, because of course this baby was on its way to the pelvis, but not deep down in, right? So a lot of fluid and some blood. I quickly grabbed some sterile gloves. The other midwife was listening to the baby. And I said, what do you have? And she's like, 70. And I said, okay, Amber. And I had just discussed after baby B came out, I said, now remember, if he doesn't change, or if there's any kind of distress, I will have to go in and get him. And we discussed that prenatally. Are you okay with that? And she said, yep, yeah, whatever you need to do. I said, hopefully we won't have to. But then I said, yeah, okay, so this is what we talked about. Are you okay? And she said, yeah. And she just, she could have stood up or squatted or whatever, but she decided to lie back. And so I had my glove on and I went in with one hand. My external hand goes onto the head of the baby so that I could kind of direct it. And my internal hand is looking for the feet. And I encountered them. I was hoping they would be right at the introitus so I didn't have to put my whole hand in and I could just say, go ahead and push, he's right here. That was not the case. He was higher up. And so high enough up that I'm in up to my wrist, you'll see on the video. And then I could feel the feet, and he was in really good condition still. So he was pulling his feet away from me. And so I was able to grab one and bring it all the way to the introitus. And we all saw it. And then he pulled it back in. And I'm like, well, this is embarrassing. So I go in again. All I could think of was, oh my gosh, these other midwives and the students are watching me, and they're thinking, does she have any idea what she's doing? This is what I'm thinking. They're thinking, of course,
there's no way that's what they were thinking. You were doing something almost no one has the skill to do.
They were just thinking
it wasn't, they were glad it wasn't them, you know, they who had to do it. So what happened? So the baby, of course, yeah.
I'm like, I need to grab both of these feet clearly and really hold on to them well. And I grabbed them, and he was fighting me. And I told the other midwife, I said, forget about heart tones, just because it had dropped to 50, but he was clearly not feeling that. And I said, just hold on to him, keep him in place so that as I bring him down, he can't go back up. And they're like, okay. So I'm bringing him down. And once I got him down to the pelvis, I said, keep pushing. And she was pushing and helping. And once his pelvis was out, then I was able to grab that, because you have to grab the bony part of the baby, because you will injure them otherwise. And so I grabbed the pelvis and I did, we call it a love sets maneuver. And just with her pushing, I rotated him to transverse, got one arm down, then rotated him back to sacrum anterior. So I'm looking at his back. And then I was just scooping the other arm. I just needed to sweep, and I lifted him up, and it's a Brock's maneuver. And he just came out easily. She was pushing, and he was small, like his siblings. And so he was going to come out just fine with no issues. And he did. And I set him right on her belly, and he was already spitting and sputtering, and his Apgars were 8, 9, I believe. So he did quite well. We got him out in a timely manner, and they had already hooked up the IV. We had Pitocin happening. We had fluids going. It was very well done on the part of the team. They worked really well. And all three babies did well. And we tucked the mama in. I think the placenta came about 45 or so minutes later. She needed to rest a bit before she was ready for that.
There was one placenta?
Yeah. So there were, so babies A and C, the placenta was a little bit fused. And then babies B was separate. So there were three placentas, but A and C were kind of fused, because as they grow, sometimes they grow, if they're growing next to each other, they tend to sort of grow together.
But I guess my question is, after babies A and B were born, was their placenta born?
No.
Or baby C? So all the placentas came out later, yeah, together?
Yeah. Yeah.
So was the cord still attached to the other babies?
Yep. There were two cord. Well, it wasn't attached to the other babies. We cut both of them. They were quite short, and we cut both of them when they were done pulsating, so that the mama could bring them up and breastfeed them.
So when baby C came out, there were two cords also.
Two cords hanging down. Two cords hanging down with little clips on them. Yeah.
Can we just touch on a couple things with BabyC I'm curious about? Sure. One, I want to just comment on the heart rate. So you had mentioned that when the first two babies leave the uterus, there's a chance that the third baby's heart rate is going to decrease. What's the reason for that? If it's not related to...
Yeah, sometimes it's cord compression. Sometimes it's they're moving and there is a cord compression. And that's all that we can assume that it would be.
Just the shift in the internal environment causing...
Yeah, exactly. And things moving around. It could be that the placentas are starting to pull away. Mm-hmm. In which case, and I think that was happening in this case, that just a little bit, because when we went to actually get the placentas, there was still, you know, when we had her push, they did not come out easily right away. They were still attached. At least one of them was, and part of the other. But I think the one had started to partially detach.
I also want to comment on the heart rate dropping down to 50 and to acknowledge that in a hospital environment, even the 70 probably would have pushed a woman into the operating room. And you knew that was a normal part of multiples delivery. And you knew because of how the baby was responding to you that the baby still had really good reserves. And so a baby who has strong reserves and who's been doing really well throughout the whole labor can tolerate a heart rate in the 50s or 60s and 70s for a period of time. Whereas in the hospital, you know, oftentimes those are the mothers who are given that emergency C-section potentially unnecessarily, and then of course told that your baby's heart rate was terrible. And that trust and that experience that you have as a midwife for so many years seeing this, that you knew that would still be okay. And you knew how the baby was responding and showing you that the baby was still okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very reassuring to me. And because we had been really monitoring C closely after A and B came out, you know, we knew he had been doing very well. And there have been a couple of comments online like, well, obviously the extraction did not need to be done because that baby was fine. That baby was fine because the extraction was done.
Because and you got the baby out quickly.
Yes. And I didn't hesitate. I knew that we had perhaps the heart rate might have gone back up. But it wasn't while we were listening. So I wasn't going to listen. I wasn't going to waste any time. And any experienced provider watching that would have said, yeah, no, that needed to be done. I stand by it 100% still. And I think that, you know, it was much faster to do that than to wheel somebody. Even if we had had a C-section just down the hallway, it still would have been faster to do the extraction and make much more sense. It's to do an emergency cesarean is much riskier than just doing an extraction maneuver. As much as I didn't want to do it, I did it. And, you know, she said afterwards, she says on one interview that I heard, you know, this was my best birth experience and it was my easiest. And I didn't expect that because it was three babies. And somebody said, well, but what about the extraction? She said, oh, it didn't hurt as much as my second birth. And that baby was cephalic and he had a big head. You know, when she gave birth 9 years ago, she still remembers the pain from the cephalic birth. And that was worse than the extraction.
And that was a hospital birth where she was probably on her back.
Yes. Yep.
So my final point on that is just for people to understand how important it is for midwives and obstetricians to have these skills, which they are no longer learning because that your skill set in that situation prevented a C-section that could have been a much different outcome for the mother and the baby.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And probably prevented a demise if there had been somebody else that didn't really know how to react to what was happening or decided to call 911 instead, that baby, it probably would not have survived. But it's a very rural place where we were. We were not in a big city. So there wasn't a hospital, you know, 5 minutes down the road. And even EMS probably, they probably have about a 10-minute response time out there. If, you know, maybe even longer, I'm not sure. But I knew that anything we encountered, I would have to be able to deal with in the moment, even if we were going to call 911, I still knew I had to deal with what I needed to do. And we didn't have to resuscitate any of the babies. The first two were Epgar's 9-10, and then Israel, his was 8-9. So then they were all nursing well, and they all nursed even before I left. So, yeah.
What percentage of your clients ended up having to have C-sections? Certainly avoided one here.
For this yeah. Case. So when I was attending home births, I think my C-section rate was about 3%. It wasn't a lot, and it wasn't for breech. It was usually just a failure to progress with the primip, and maybe there was, you know, asyncletism, and we tried everything, and we got to the hospital, and then they did Pitocin and an epidural, and it wasn't that many, and it was for just very rare and strange things. One of them was for a face presentation with a baby that had achondroplasia, so dwarfism. So the head was quite large, so that face was not coming out. So for very good reasons, I would say. Yeah. And when I'm in the field, actually, curiously enough, we don't have good access to cesarean. And when we do, we only use it for maternal indications. So I'm essentially required to get all babies out, regardless of what even the outcome for that baby is going to be. It's never to save the baby's life. It's for the sake of the mother that we'll do a C-section. So I have to get all babies out vaginally. Then my C-section rate in South Sudan, in a refugee camp, after 6 months was just over, slightly over 4%. And that's because in November we get transferred all, it was a high risk maternity that I was in charge of, and we get sent high risk cases. And so I had like six plus complete previous in the month of November. And so those went to C-section.
Being you and having your knowledge and living in your skin, I'm just wondering, what are your emotions around the reality that a third of American women, and far more of other women in other populations like Brazil, I mean, vast majority are having C-sections. How do you feel when you think about that?
Yeah, it makes me so sad, and it makes me and angry and frustrated, of course, too. And not only that, but so many of them are coerced. And I read it all the time on threads. I'll post something, and then somebody will say, oh, they told me that I needed to have a cesarean because of that, and now I know that they lied to me. And women are really being damaged. And there's just so much obstetric trauma happening. And it just makes me very sad. But I teach for Breech Without Borders. I'm one of their instructors. And we're teaching more and more in hospitals. And even when we're not in hospitals, we get obstetricians taking our class on their own. And so they are learning breech maneuvers, and they are, you know, slowly, at least cesareans for breeches might go down a little bit, at least in some of these places. There are some hospitals that are really committed to offering breech services. So I have a little bit of hope, and I try to focus on what we're doing right and what I can help do. And if that's educate the next generation of obstetricians, I'm more than happy to do that. I love teaching.
Thanks for joining us at the Down to Birth Show. You can reach us at Down to Birth Show on Instagram or email us at contact@downtobirthshow.com. All of Cynthia's classes and Trisha's breastfeeding services are held live, online, serving women and couples everywhere.
Please remember, this information is made available to you for educational and informational purposes only. It is in no way a substitute for medical advice. For our full disclaimer, visit downtobirthshow.com/disclaimer. Thanks for tuning in. And as always, hear everyone and listen to yourself.
Someday, Christine, I hope my children will be out of the house, that I will have the opportunity to learn from you. It would be so amazing to get some of these skills. So I hope that we can stay in touch and really, really impressed and respect the work that you're doing.
No, oh, thank you. Yeah, I would love that. I love to work with other midwives, and I appreciate the collaboration. Everybody has something to bring to the table. So, and you know, I said to another somebody after the birth we were talking about the other midwives that were there. And, you know, I said, if you had walked into that room, you would not have been able to tell who was in charge, because we were all just sitting there quietly, you know, and I don't consider myself in charge. I think the mom's in charge, but I like to call myself like the team leader. When something needed to be done, you see that I'm doing what I needed to do and the rest of them are helping. And then, you know, I said, get ready to resuscitate. Like, I'm leading the team. We didn't have to resuscitate, but not until then would you have been able to tell who in this room was quote unquote managing this birth. Cause mm-hmm. I wasn't managing anything. I was just observing.